Revenue Committee for April 3rd, 2007 will come to order. We have a number of things on our agenda for today. I do expect more members of the committee to join us. There were late caucuses scheduled today at 12:30. I think what we've learned from this experience is that we can't schedule late caucuses and expect committees to start on time. And I apologize for those who have been waiting for the committee to begin. We carried over our information meeting on medical provider taxes. I believe you have sign-ins.
These are the three folks who are going to talk.
Okay.
All right. Sign-ins.
Oh, okay. Let's go ahead with that. That's the information meeting.
All right. Jim Scherzinger, Julie Huddleston, and James Taves.
Taves. Okay. Great. We're going to open our information meeting on medical provider taxes and ask the panel that we had earlier asked to come and talk to us about that to come forward. Jim Scherzinger, Julia Huddleston, and James Taves. And our subject today is the medical provider taxes generally, and I think what the committee wanted to understand was what the theory of these taxes was, what they're intended to provide, and why do we have this curious situation in which, under some circumstances at least, some of the people who are subject to the tax actually support it. That doesn't follow the usual rule of tax the man behind the tree. That being said, go ahead.
I'm Jim Scherzinger, Deputy for Finance for the Department of Human Services, and I have a couple handouts, and I think if you took those two handouts that I hope are there from the meeting, the earlier scheduled meeting, and sort of just lay them next to each other rather than take them sequentially. This is a very rough overview of provider taxes, and you have some specific bills, a couple of them on the agenda today, and then two tomorrow that deal more specifically with the different provider taxes that exist in Oregon. But I'll try to just give you a general overview, and then when you get to those specific bills, you can have whatever discussions you want to have about the specifics of that particular tax. And maybe to get to the chair's first question right away is, what's the purpose of a provider tax? And it's right there sort of outlined. The primary purpose of a provider tax is to leverage federal funds. Two-thirds of the DHS budget, Department of Human Services budget, is Medicaid. When I say that, that's the state share plus the federal share of that comes together to constitute the state spending on Medicaid. So for every dollar of state funds that we raise and put into the Medicaid program, we receive about $1.50 in federal funds. So a provider tax, imposing a $1 tax on medical providers, ends up raising not only that dollar, but another $1.50, or a total of $2.50, that can be spent for Medicaid services, which explains why some might be willing to pay the tax, at least from an industry-wide perspective. And so many states impose provider taxes to enhance their Medicaid programs, and that's the reason they do it. Now, it's not as easy as it sounds, and the reason it's not as easy as it sounds is the federal government, for obvious reasons, has regulated provider taxes to ensure that they are real taxes. That is, they're not simply taxing somebody, taking their money and giving it back to them on an individual basis and just adding the federal funds. So in effect, there really is no state participation. It's simply a pass-through. And so they have some regulations about provider taxes to, as I say, ensure that they are real taxes. And like any regulations, well, let me just talk about the theory of them in general. In general, the theory is that the taxes must be broad-based, they must be uniformly imposed, and they cannot hold taxpayers harmless. In other words, they cannot guarantee that a taxpayer gets back more money than they pay in tax when ultimately the Medicaid revenues are distributed back to providers to pay for the services that they provide. And because of these regulations, a federal agency must approve the tax exemptions that once we create one of these taxes, if there are exemptions from the tax, they need to approve those exemptions. And another thing about the taxes is the hold harmless provisions effectively limit the tax rate that can be charged. Currently, that limit is 6% of revenue, and effective January 1, 2008, that limit will be reduced to 5.5%. So there's effectively a limit on the tax that can be imposed. And then, effective on October 1, 2009, the managed care tax must meet a stricter broad-based test than it currently does. And so there is a big question on the managed care tax as to whether or not it would, certainly can't continue in its current form, but whether or not it would continue after that date. So when you look at the managed care tax bill, you'll see a sunset date in there that attaches to that date, and it's because the federal law provisions about that tax changes on that date. So I have a second sheet that lists the three provider taxes that Oregon currently imposes. All of them sunset, and so there is a bill on each one of them to continue the tax into the next biennium. The bills that the department has introduced are listed there for each of the three taxes. House Bill 2177, which is on Medicaid managed care organizations. House Bill 2178, with a set of proposed amendments that I believe you have, which is the one of the bills that's up today, long-term care facilities, and 2183, which is a provider tax for hospitals, which you have up tomorrow. 2177 and 2183 up tomorrow. The current rates, well, let me just take each one of these in turn. The Medicaid managed care organizations, the current rate, or the rate that's assumed, let's put it this way, in the governor's budget, I think these are all the current rates right now. 5.8% of Medicaid revenue on the managed care organizations. It raises about $146 million. This is the amount that's assumed in the governor's budget from that rate. $146 million in tax in the next biennium. That would be matched with roughly $230 million of federal funds for a total revenue, in effect, generated from the tax on the federal funds of about $377 million. The bill has a sunset date of October 1, 2009, and those funds are used for the core benefit in the Oregon Health Plan, the standard plan within the Oregon Health Plan, and for payment increases to managed care organizations. That's the use of the funds. On the bill you have up today, or one of the bills you have up today, House Bill 2178, is the tax on long-term care facilities. That tax is actually a dollar per bed day, but that rate is calculated to achieve a certain percentage of revenue, which currently is 6% of revenue, and the current rate per bed day is $1,373. At 6% of revenue, the tax would raise the next biennium about $79 million, and adding the federal match, about $204 million. There are exemptions for the Oregon Veterans Home, for facilities that have high percentage of Medicaid patients, and for continuing care retirement facilities. The sunset date in the bill, and I think this is the amendments, are 2012 in the department's amendments, the amendments to the department's bill, and the use of the funds is Medicaid payment rates to long-term care facilities. So that's how the use of the funds. You also have a bill which is, I guess you would call it the industry bill, House Bill 2563 that deals with that same tax. In general, for all of these taxes, there really aren't the issues that come up around these are typically not the issues of the tax itself, but more how the funds are used, how the funds are spent, how much general fund might go into these programs as well as tax revenue. Those are typically the issues that arise. And I think in all of these cases, we have essential agreement on the form of the tax, the whatever issues are there, and I'm sure you'll hear, or Ways and Means will hear about whatever those issues are typically around the use of the funds. Okay, and then the House Bill 2183, which is up tomorrow, is the provider tax on hospitals. The tax rate currently 8.82% of revenue. Raises $103 million in the next biennium at that rate, and with the federal match, $267 million. And there are exemptions that are listed there, sunset date, and that revenue is used for the hospital portion of the managed care rate that goes that is paid to managed care organizations, and fee-for-service payments under the standard plan, and then payment enhancement to hospitals for fee-for-service under all the plans that are operated under Medicaid. Also, some notes on the bottom that you might want to take a look at. But that's a quick overview of provider taxes. I'd be glad to address any questions. We also have people from the department here and from the industry that can talk about the specific bills.
Thank you, and we will open on the specific bills in a minute. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, what's the expectation about these taxes being passed along?
Passed along in?
I mean, in other words, is the expectation that these providers would turn around and just bill somebody else for these amounts?
Well, they pay the tax like any tax. There will be some providers that are, quote, winners. They will get more back in additional payments than they're paying in tax. And there'll be other providers that could be losers. They'll get less back than they would pay in tax. But, you know, it's a cost of doing business like any other cost of doing business. So, generally speaking, if you have a high percentage of Medicaid payments, then you're going to get, or Medicaid patients, you're going to get more, you're going to benefit from the higher payments that you'll get for those Medicaid payments, Medicaid patients. And generally, if you have relatively few and you're still subject to the tax, then you'll be a loser and it just becomes a cost of doing business.
Mm, follow up.
Yes.
What I was really asking though is, so if you pay these as the provider, then do you generally turn around if you've got somebody you can bill? Whether it's insurance companies or, you know, private pay patients or whatever, do you generally just go collect the same amount from them?
Ooh, I don't know. You'd have to ask the individual providers sort of how they handle that.
I think that'd be a great question for some of them, too. Yeah.
Haven't thought about it that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. There are, Representative Gelser, did you have some? Mm-hmm. No. There are some providers who either don't take Medicaid patients or otherwise are in a situation where they don't, as you say, they're net losers, who may in fact end up paying the tax without any benefit to their own operations. Is that true?
I think there would be some. I think it differs by the tax. The managed care tax is more limited to Medicaid, people with Medicaid payments than the other two are, and that's one reason why its future is less certain, because those new provisions are going to affect its ability to impose the tax the way it's imposed now.
Do we have any sense that we could impose a different tax that was potentially broader that would save this one?
You could do that. It would be a pretty large increase.
So one would presume this is something that perhaps the 09 legislature may want to look at. But we shouldn't be borrowing trouble. Is that?
Well, that's your choice.
Okay. All right.
You get to make that choice.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We appreciate that introduction, and I think we're ready to open it on the bills. All right. And who do we have?
Jim Carlson's here.
Okay.
Republican caucus is just breaking up.
Okay. They'll be here shortly. All right. We're going to stand at ease. All right. And so we're done with them.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And we will close the information meeting, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2178 and House Bill 2563. We've already done the summary, haven't we? Let's hear from Mr. Carlson and Mr. Taves. And more.
If you want, yeah.
Please.
We invited Ruth Golias with the Oregon Alliance Senior Health Services to, for the record, Jim Carlson, Oregon Healthcare Association, and I'll let others, when they jump in, introduce themselves. We've got a handout that came from seniors and people with disabilities that from Mr. Tave's shop here that actually compares 2178 and 2563, the two provider tax bills, and that probably is the simplest document to show you where the differences are. What I would like to say is we've been working very hard. We supported our organization and our membership 4 years ago, the original legislation. We've been working very hard in meetings with the Department of Human Services, Mr. Taves and his folks, for a number of months to try to come to agreement on the reauthorization of the tax. House Bill 2178 is a DHS agency request bill. House Bill 2563 is legislation that we requested to be introduced. The one-pager basically discusses where there's agreement in some areas where there's still some ongoing discussions, and really the one area where we have not reached final agreement on relates to what Mr. Scherzinger referred to is how the dollars are paid out. Essentially, we've got pretty much universal agreement on the tax portion, and on the payout portion, when you go down to where it says minimum floor payment on that one page, the fundamental issue here, even though we've got some different indicators on rate setting, like the fundamental issue from our perspective is that 2178 permits much more to be done in administrative rule, whereas 2563 nails some of that down more specifically in statute. And so I think that's a key issue. And so you do have, I think Mr. Scherzinger did an excellent job of saying that you've got, you know, kind of the budget side of this and you've got kind of the revenue side, and this is the bill dealing with the revenue side, but it does impact decisions on the budget side. And if I might, Mr. Chair, just to Representative Rosenbaum's question about what certain providers may or may not do in terms of passing this along. We had a situation 4 years ago when the initial law was passed, as Mr. Scherzinger did an excellent job of outlining. You have winners and losers in this regard on these provider taxes. Most of your licensed nursing facility providers in Oregon have Medicaid contracts, and many of them have very high Medicaid levels. Medicaid's the single largest payer source for nursing facility care, but we did have some providers 4 years ago who cost shifted some of the costs from the provider tax to private pay residents that they were serving for. Primarily it was fairly limited, but in situations where you had a facility that might be 100% private pay or mostly private pay, and it was a significant cost, you did see that. You have some limits, if you will, in the marketplace on what folks can charge for services. The market will bear what the market will bear, and if somebody was trying to cost shift or pass along costs significantly higher than market rates, you know, obviously they're going to be impacted by that. But we did have that situation. I think the market adjusted out in the ensuing 4 years on some of those costs of doing business, I think was the description used. But the answer to your question was yes, you did see some cost shifting occur at that point in time. If we, because we were in the midst of that budget crisis in 03, if we had taken the reductions in general fund funding levels that we were expecting we were going to take without turning to the provider tax mechanism, the amount of cost shifting you would have seen to offset that lost general fund and associated federal funds probably would have been far greater than what we saw through the imposition of the provider tax at that time. And so that's small consolation I know to folks, maybe constituents and others out there who wouldn't have quite as clear understanding how some of that works. But based on where we were at that point in time from a budget standpoint, it did ensue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Ruth, James.
Good afternoon. I'm Ruth Gullius. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, and we are the not-for-profit mission-directed association. We've got, we represent a not-for-profit mission-directed low-income housing, federally subsidized housing, nursing homes, assisted living residential care, and continuing care retirement communities. And I just wanted to speak very briefly about the provider tax from the not-for-profit perspective. First, it was, I'm not going to get into the details, it was absolutely critical when it came to be in maintaining the access that rural Oregonians, particularly rural Oregonians, had to quality nursing homes. And I meant to start by saying I've put on your handout, I've listed next year names, some of the not-for-profit nursing homes and long-term care providers, so that you're aware of, you're probably already aware of them, and I know that Representative Butler has been out to some of them. But it was really critical, particularly in rural Oregon, and we've had often, if we wouldn't have had the provider tax, it would have really challenged the viability of the nursing homes out there. One in particular, Presbyterian Community Care Center, is the only nursing home in several skilled facility in several thousand square miles. And again, it was really critical and really important to those communities. And I wanted to also talk about just the not-for-profits, how they've developed over time. They've been in the communities in Oregon often for many decades. They may have started out being a nursing home because that was the need in the community at the time. And then as they've assessed needs and communities needs changed over time, they may have added fairly subsidized housing for low-income seniors, assisted living, and some of them will take Medicaid and some of them won't. And that just depends on sort of how the variety and the model that they've got in place. So the exemptions that were being spoken about earlier were important to the richness and maintaining the richness of the models that are in existence out there. And we really strongly felt that at the initial implementation of the provider tax that we needed to do the best in crafting that to come up with a solution that worked for all and really underscored the richness of the models and the public-private partnership taking place in some of the communities. Thirdly, I'd just like to say as we move forward on the provider tax and we look at reimbursement methodologies for nursing homes, that we consider looking at methodologies that look at the needs of residents within communities as well as the differing needs, as well as ways to incentivize quality. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, James Tays from the Department of Human Services. Just as a little bit of background on the role of nursing facilities in Oregon, which is distinctly different than from most states, out of almost 30,000 people, seniors and people with disabilities that we serve in the state, we have slightly less than 5,000 Medicaid clients in nursing homes, and that's a pretty remarkable statistic compared to most states. In fact, Oregon has the lowest per capita rate of nursing home usage of any place in the country. And that means several things. One, that we serve people with much higher and complex needs in community-based systems, but that means the people that are left in nursing homes or come out of hospitals and stay there for a short period of time and then leave and either go back home or into another community-based setting. In general, Oregon serves a much higher acuity population in nursing homes. We're not sort of a long-term placement setting that nursing homes are used for. So in many ways, our nursing homes have become almost an extension of our acute care system, and I think that trend will continue. When we started in 2001, before the year before, the biennium before the tax, the provider tax started, we were at a base rate of about $111 a day, one of the lower rates in the country, notwithstanding the fact that we tended to serve people with more complex needs than most other parts of the country. So we really started at a point of some pretty significant needs, and I think going back to the chairperson's question, why would people step forward and say, please tax me? This became a real methodology where we could incrementally increase the rates to be much more competitive. And since that time, starting at that base of $111 a day, with the provider tax fueling much of the increase, we're now at about $165 a day. And in the governor's budget, that continues to go up to almost $180 a day in 2007. So the tax has played a very important role in stabilizing that part of the industry as we continue to struggle with exactly the mix of people that will remain for hopefully short periods of times in nursing home settings. As Mr. Carlson indicated, we've been negotiating for some months now. I think we're fairly close. We've agreed on all the sort of technical tax provisions. What we're now down to is the rate methodology, whether it's in statute or a rule or a combination between the two. What the department is concerned about is the general fund growth sort of outside of the increase that's fueled by the tax and the federal match that comes with the tax itself. So we're trading formulas in terms of what kind of ceilings we might have on the general fund growth and, of course, continue to have the tax itself and the federal fund match that goes with that continue to augment the rate over time. So we're continuing to work on that, and I hope we can come to an agreement here fairly quickly. The other thing, the federal government, Congress intervened. The Centers on Medicaid and Medicare were about to drop the sort of the safe harbor in which you can tax within from 6% to 3%. Would have been a huge hit. Congress actually intervened and set it at 5.5 now for I think the next 3 years it is. So we're actually recalculating the tax rate, and we'll probably have a slight margin that we have to make up even to get to the governor's recommended budget level because of that decrease. But actually it was good news. Congress actually intervened to stop rulemaking that would have really caused a pretty severe hit. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Just one question.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the graph which we have showing the amounts of general funds starting at 155, now in the GRB at 133. Do we have any equivalent to these numbers in general funds that are being expended by the adjacent states or by all states the Medicaid programs?
If I might, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'd be happy to get you from it's the MedStat database that compares Medicaid expenditure state to state for the last year on a full report. I'd be happy to get you the Oregon numbers compared to the other states. And as Mr. Taze indicated, Oregon probably has done a better job than any state in the country in making sure we don't have inappropriate nursing facility utilization. But I'd be happy to provide that to you. The one other thing that I didn't overlay on that chart that I should mention is you have had some caseload variation in that period, but what you saw in that big jump when you went from 2003 to 2005 was really the infusion of the provider tax dollars was the big difference there. And then we've slowed the rate of growth in the general fund, and that's the primary issue we're continuing to discuss with the department right now on the go-forward basis is that component of it. But I think it's fair to say it's been a win-win for both the provider community and for the state in terms of, you know, conserving general fund resources.
Mr. Chair, if I may, my question is really to elicit a couple of comments and some confirmation of what I've been led to believe may be the case. Number one, the rates that we started with in Oregon were extraordinarily low. In other words, yes. The federal reimbursement was extraordinarily low. Therefore, as a state, we had to commit more general funds from day one with regard to these kinds of patient care issues. Secondly, if we took this as a percentage of gross income of Oregonians, if we took it as a percentage of our general fund budget and those kinds of things, I think that we would see some rather stark numbers coming out of it. And I guess my concern is that have we done anything, reassure me again, what it is that we've done with our congressional delegation to go back and say, wait a minute, everything ought to be rebased now that we know, because we were doing an extraordinarily good job before the feds got involved in it, why can't we rebase based upon what our real needs are?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the discussion at the federal level that really ensued over the last year or two is the administration wanted to cap how much states could get in terms of on provider tax. So they wanted to cap it. The federal law had been in reg at 6% was that maximum. They wanted to bring that down to 3%. So we stood to actually lose, you know, significant amounts of money off of this. And our congressional delegation, actually Senator White and Senator Smith in particular, were very helpful in stepping up and now locking in federal law in statute through 2011, that 5.5% rate. There has been no discussion to reward states that have been cost-effective other than, I guess, it's our own reward in that we do not utilize as much general fund dollars to provide the services. Oregon probably has been able to do more, serve more people in a variety of long-term care settings and options for less dollars. But I think that'd be the best way I could respond. But we don't necessarily get a bonus from the feds for our efficiency, unfortunately.
Thank you. Yeah.
That sounds very familiar, doesn't it, to a whole lot of other things.
Fortunately, yes, yeah.
Other rates related to the fact that we were more efficient than Florida, for example,
right.
A long time ago, and that we've been punished for being good ever since.
Yeah.
Makes you want to be bad for a while, doesn't it?
No, actually it doesn't. But it does make me want to get the feds to change the incentives a little bit.
Yeah.
Are there other questions for this panel? This is a complex area. Let me just say a couple of things about the discussions that are taking place in other places about these bills, and that is that obviously we're not going to pass them all because they relate to the same subject matter. We're also are looking at the possibility of combining several different bills together as we look at an overall response to the issue rather than dealing simply with the individual types of provider. I wonder, too, if any of you would be willing to take a minute or two to talk about how other aspects of our healthcare system allow us to be such a low population state as far as a nursing home care is concerned. How do we manage that? Can you give us a very short kind of overview of that issue?
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually beginning in 1981, Oregon was the very first state that accessed a new provision passed under the Reagan administration that allowed states to use Medicaid dollars in non-institutional settings. In fact, the regs weren't even out. The print was barely dry on the legislation itself, and Oregon had its proposal in, which essentially said for anyone historically who had an institutional level of care, if you could provide their support in community-based settings, you could draw down the same level of federal match in your Medicaid program. And you can chart 1981 on, and the percentage of people served in nursing homes continued to decline, actually until last year. Now it's kind of stabilized, and at the same time, the growth of community-based services increased dramatically. Oregon has probably the biggest and most robust home care program in the country. We serve almost 12,000 people in their own homes with home care workers, chore services, things of that sort. We have roughly 5,000 in nursing homes, and then we have about another 10,000 in assisted living, foster care, residential care facilities across the state. So it is a very generous mix of community-based alternatives, which people have embraced over time and then chosen those types of service alternatives. The other neat thing that happened in Oregon is much of this was planned sort of in conjunction with the provider industry as well, so that you really created a marketplace for private pay as well. Mm-hmm. You'll see in many other states someone gets discharged out of a hospital, they go into a nursing home, they hit their private pay, they spend down quickly, then they're on Medicaid because there are no other alternatives. In Oregon, if your needs don't rise to the level of skilled nursing care and you can go into a foster home or have someone support you in your own home, obviously you're gonna tank your private pay portion much more slowly, and that actually saves the state because you sort of delay the period that the person will come on to the full Medicaid program. So it's really been a combination of leadership. Actually, the Oregon legislature in 1981 passed a remarkable piece of legislation that sort of created the Senior Services Division and then added disabilities later. And it's still looked at as probably the best legislation in the country that sort of laid the groundwork for this whole system. And many states still look to Oregon to try to emulate. Right now, in terms of leadership, Oregon ranks top of any state that spends its the biggest percentage of its budget on community-based services. There's only four other states that actually spend over 50% in non-institutional care, and I think it's our neighbors to the north, Washington, New Mexico, Alaska, and Vermont, I think it is. And everybody else is way down the pack. It's not uncommon for states to spend 60, 70, 80% of their long-term care budgets in nursing care as opposed to Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure James knows I can't let the opportunity to make this comment pass. While we do kind of lead the nation in community-based care for adults, we do still have 60 Oregon children who are growing up in nursing facilities whose average length of stay exceeds 7 years, whereas for adults it's less than 3 months. And I'd like to commend the department for the adoption of some rules that's going to help divert more kids to community-based placements, and Mr. Carlson's been part of those conversations as well, and we have the opportunity in this legislative session to adopt some legislation that's now over in Ways and Means to help keep more kids at home, out of nursing homes, and out of foster care because it is less expensive in addition to being the right thing to do.
Right. Thank you. So if I could follow up on that little crazy then, if we are to make comparisons between Oregon and other states, in terms of dollars per person, things of that sort, we can't make it on the basis of our nursing home patients versus nursing home patients in other states. It has to be on the basis of the entire community-based and nursing home populations as compared to the other states' nursing home and community-based populations if we're going to make a comparison that makes any sense. Is that a reasonable... I'm getting head nods. Is that a reasonable kind of observation?
Correct, Mr. Chairperson. You really can't draw that many parallels. And the other thing that Oregon and a lot of states have followed suit, but we also stretched the definition of institutional level of care as broad as we could so that we could fund as many people on the community side with our Medicaid program, our Medicaid waivers, and We have people that are supported with maybe 10, 15, 20 hours a month of in-home care, and yet we declare that they're nursing home eligible simply so we can capture the Medicaid dollars. Many states don't do that. They just sort of deal with the nursing home eligibility, and they have very little access in the community side. So it really is apples and cauliflowers. I mean, there really aren't a lot of comparators.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think this gets at Representative Butler's question a few minutes ago. Representative Butler.
It does, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. And I just want to share with the committee something that you probably already have known for many, many years, something I didn't know until this last year. But typically, nationwide, nursing homes are where you go to die. In Oregon, nursing homes are where you go to get well and go home back to these other kinds of activities. We have a totally different paradigm when it comes to our nursing homes. It's a place where you convalesce and get back into the community, get back with your family, back into your own home, back into the homes and surroundings which you're familiar and comfortable with. And I think this is really wonderful that Oregon has changed the way that you think of a nursing home. I had somebody say that to me the other day. Nursing home where you go to die. And I said, not in Oregon.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if I might, approximately half of all admissions to nursing facilities are discharged back to their own home. And then when you look on other discharge destinations and you start to look on foster care, assisted living, residential care, a significant number. In terms of for out-of-hospital death rates, which is something actually tracked, Oregon has a higher out-of-hospital death rate, and you do provide much end-of-life care in the nursing facility setting oftentimes. But that's actually a positive indicator for the most part in the sense that it's a more cost-effective setting if somebody has some complex medical needs for end-of-life care than it is on an extended hospital stay. And so even when you're tracking that death rate component, that is a better setting for end-of-life care oftentimes.
The other, if I might, Mr. Chairperson, the other key thing that Oregon did that, again, many other states are struggling is really integrated all of the eligibility and the service options at the local level. So we now have area agencies on aging, the AAA system. In a few parts of the state where there are not AAAs, we have state offices. And a senior or a person with disability, they go there, they get eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, for food stamps, for other federal programs like the Older Americans Act, Medicaid eligibility, and it's all sort of wrapped up in the same place. So you can really sort of look at a person's needs walking in the door and get them to the right place at the right time compared to most states where, and I've dealt with aging parents in other states where literally, and I think I know this field, had to, spend hours, days, weeks trying to find appropriate supports for my parents. So it's structurally much different than other states as well, and again, that's based on some very wise leadership historically.
Thank Mr. You. Chair, if I may add too, there's
yes,
another important aspect that really helped the development of options here in Oregon too, and it's the Nurses Practices Act and the interpretation of that, the delegation of nursing that allowed a variety of tasks to be performed outside of nursing homes that you cannot in a variety of states. So Oregon has done just a tremendous amount of public policy changes throughout the course of time that have just built upon each other to really allow us to do what we can do so well here.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't go without saying that I really appreciate the good work these folks do, and when you have a problem in your community with senior issues, James Tate has come to the bat for me time after time in these kinds of issues to help out. And it's not just to get the water to the row on one case or one kind of situation. It's to actually help structurally set up the kinds of things in your community which leaves your community better off for your seniors, your disabled, and your handicapped, and other folks that need these services. And so I wanted to express my personal appreciation here at the dais for the work that Mr. Taves and his staff does for all of Oregonians. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anything else for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much. I think that at this point, the best thing for us all to say is stay tuned. You're working on it. Let us know how it's coming.
We'll do our best, Mr. Chair, to get complete agreement.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So does the rest of the committee. Are there others to be heard today on House Bill 2178 or 2563? I don't see any hands going up, so I'm assuming that we can close the public hearing, and we do so on House Bill 2178 and House Bill 2563. And now we're going to switch topics. Are you ready? 29. Right. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2965. Chris, did you have some things you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's nothing new from last time. This is just to remind the committee, this is the bill that phases out the senior medical expenses deduction. This is the up to the 7.5% of medical expenses that Oregonians are allowed to deduct on their state taxes. And it phases it out for single filers from income of $100,000 to $125,000 and for joint filers between $200,000 and $250,000. And it has a preliminary revenue impact of 709 of plus $9.2 million.
Okay. Representative Berger.
I see by my notes we've heard this bill before.
Yes.
I don't remember testimony on it. From staff, is this considered a tax increase bill? Does this require a 36 vote?
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. I think that our conversation around this particular bill is that this is a bill that, at this stage at least, the issues don't involve very much money. Well, actually, it's about about $9 million in this biennium. The most important. So that's a substantial amount. But the most important.
I don't know what your checkbook was like, but that's a lot of money to me.
No, I said that before I looked at the draft impact statement, revenue impact statement. As I look at it, I realize it's more than I thought. But the point is that the issue that this bill raises is an issue of the long-term impact of this deduction on our state income tax because of the demographic changes that are taking place as those of us in the baby boom generation all get older. So I think that's something that I would ask the staff to take a look at and to see how that impacts, how this bill change might impact things a few years out, recognizing that that may be a little more speculative than what would fit in a revenue impact statement. Because after a while, tax deductions for those who are well off begin to impact our capacity to care for people in the groups who were represented by the group that we just heard from on the other day. And I have heard from at least one group of representing older folks that they don't want to be heard on the bill. They're not concerned about the bill. It's not a big issue for them one way or the other. And I think it's because they have members who are in both income groups, those who would benefit from state-supported services and those who might benefit from the tax deduction at the top end.
I have a question. Representative Butler. A question of staff, yes, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you very much. When we're talking about age 62 and older with largely passive income, first of all, this is with regard to federal AGI, or this with regard to state, begin with the first number carryover.
Representative Butler, the way the bill was drafted, it actually refers to household income and references household income as defined for the Elderly Rental Assistance Program.
Okay.
And there is a request to have that changed to federal AGI.
So,
an amendment.
Change to federal AGI.
Yes.
And then my next question, because household income was always very difficult under the rent relief program, HARP, and those other kinds of things. Change to federal AGI, we could very possibly then have folks over age 62 who have passive income divert their passive income source into municipal bonds, and the only thing that would be reflected here then would be 85% of their cap of their Social Security, basically.
Possibly.
So, in other words, if someone was making $10,000 in Social Security under the federal AGI rule, $8,500 of it would show as AGI, and potentially hundreds of thousands then could flow through as municipal bond income and really not be reflected. So that you could have people that were making $300,000 or $400,000 and would qualify for 100% deduction under this method. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Do you have a suggested fix for that?
Mr. Chair, I think probably the starting point would be the old HARP program where you look at your household income. That was a very difficult difficult calculation because you had to have access to more information to determine where to start from. But that would be the more... If you're going to means test, mm-hmm. that would be the more fair way to means test, not being able to have money, because gifts are also included under the old HARP program, family gifts. And so if I've got, but really when you start with a range of 100,000 single and 200,000 joint, gifts probably aren't going to be an issue. They're not normally the recipients of gifts. So it would probably be the means testing probably ought to be on household income. Then you've got the son that lives at home that comes back and lives with dad and mom for 6 months or a year to look after them, and he just happens to have a $2 million salary from Hewlett Packard. And what happens is that's then means tested in there, and because that's part of the household income. So it's a start. It's a start for the means test.
So you really like the idea of the household income approach better than the idea of AGI?
AGI, because it's the Full Accountant's Employment Act.
Once again,
drumming up business for the accountants.
Now, the reality is that the vast majority of Oregonians will not be affected by this bill at all, will they?
No, it's a small. It is not a majority of the Oregonians.
In fact, it's a very, very tiny minority, isn't it?
Yes, 10,000 filers or so.
10,000. How many filers do we have?
1.6, 1.7 million.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a very small number. It may be an employment act for CPAs, but it won't be a full employment act for CPAs. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I'd like to emphasize a couple things that you've mentioned. One, as we age, that 10,000 is on a pretty stark upward curve. It may be 10,000 now, but this will impact. And I'd also like to point out that the way medical expenses are going, they become very egregious in a hurry under circumstances that are not controllable. It may seem like somebody making $200,000 a year household income, it can just withstand anything, but let me tell you, in case of sudden certain types of medical things, that could eat that up in a heartbeat and leave someone in really bad straits. So let's be clear what we're talking about here. It may seem like a bunch of numbers, but to people who get caught up in this, suddenly none of it's deductible and all of their money is going to some medical expense and none of it is deductible anymore or only a portion of it is, and it can have a pretty devastating effect. So I'm not at all satisfied with the starting range and the finishing range on this as it is currently written.
Great, appreciate that. Perhaps Chris, you could walk us through the way the deduction works now and In the catastrophic case that Representative Berger is referring to, tell us what effect the current law would have on a person's taxes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way the deduction works now is it's tied to, on the federal return, for those that itemize the deduction at the federal level, they are allowed to deduct medical and dental expenses, but only to the extent they exceed 7.5% of their AGI. This deduction is an Oregon-only deduction for filers age 62 or over, and it allows them to deduct the portion that cannot be deducted at the federal level. So essentially, Oregonians age 62 and over can deduct all of their medical and dental expenses.
On their Oregon.
On their Oregon return, because Oregon return. The above 7.5% will flow through to their they tie in the itemized deduction, and this piece gets added onto that deduction. So for Oregon purposes, the medical and dental expenses are fully deducted.
So just to back up, and let me just finish this point, if I may. So the effect of this bill, let's take the numbers here. If you had $125,000, $125,000 of a household income and you were a single filer, and catastrophic medical expenses, under the current law, you could deduct 7.5% of that number from Oregon income in addition to everything above that because of the current federal law, and have a zero income for tax purposes in Oregon. With this bill as it exists, if it passed, then your income would be 7.5% of the $125,000 that would be reported as income. Have I got that right, or have I missed it?
I'm not sure I followed the arithmetic there, but okay. If you're talking about somebody that is $100,000 and they're single, the cutoff point is 7.5% of that.
Right.
And any medical expenses, if their medical expenses were $50,000 or $200,000, then the amount that can be deducted is just the part above the 7.5% demarcation.
Right.
And if it's possible that a taxpayer couldn't utilize that full deduction if, in a catastrophic case, all of their income would be deducted.
Right.
And that would be almost irrespective of the Oregon law. If the medical expenses were less than their AGI, say they were $10,000, then they would be allowed to deduct the full piece. Part of it would show up, would flow through to the schedule on the Schedule A, and part of it would be due to this piece of legislation.
Okay, that's helpful.
This is a much smaller number than we might otherwise be thinking about. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. I appreciate the comments that were made about how quickly medical bills can add up and how quickly that can be catastrophic. But I hope when we consider this, we can kind of weigh why would that be different for someone over 65 rather than for someone under that. I know that it's 7.5% because as the parent of a young child with very complex medical needs, we've exceeded that 7.5% before, and there are many families who are like that are caring for people under the age of 65 that have very complex and expensive medical needs, and yet we don't reach out and provide help or assistance to these people. And when they're providing care for a parent or for a child, that frequently means that they are no longer able to work because they're needing to care for that very ill person. So I just ask, as we move forward, it's important to take care of and support our seniors, and I want to do that, but I also want to recognize that for families and for family caregivers, there is a lot of need out there as well for people that are under 65 that face some of the very same problems, and we need to be helping them as well.
Thank you. And there was another hand down in this direction. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was while you were in contact with Chris and questioning. Chris, do we have any of the research as to how, when this was implemented, what the circumstances were around it? And I want to preface that by saying, not to say that it's a correction of where you were going, but if we are using household income, the 7.5% isn't necessarily the number here, because a lot of things, as I say, when the son comes home to take care of dad and mom and lives with them for 6 months while they're convalescing, his income is considered to be household income to the family. So we've got to be very cautious about that, because it is entirely conceivable that the only thing that would be taxable to these folks would be the portion which we're adding back as a medical cost here. So and at 9%, if they've used up everything that they have in their resources in the way of their income and some of their principal as well, then what happens is that they're adding back the 7.5%, or they're in effect paying the 7.5% out and taxing it in effect for Oregon purposes based upon the fact that it is not AGI, it is really based upon household income. But do we know anything about the history of how Oregon became, and I thought it originally started, even the younger age, 58 was the recollection that I had. Is that correct?
Yes, it was, originally it was 58, and then
it scaled up.
When it scaled up.
And then it got to 62, so for 4 years it phased in.
Yes.
And then at that particular point it just stayed at 62. What was the theory behind it at the time?
I don't know the answer to that. I can do a little research. And
I'm wondering if it wouldn't help to have just to find out what the originators of this, because Oregon is probably unique in the way that it does this. I don't know if there are any other states that do this add back, Chris, and that would be important, I think, to know. Do you have that information at the fingertips?
I don't think there are many that do this kind of add back. I struggle to come up with another state that does this.
I know of no other state which does it, and I used to practice in all 50 states, so I'm not sure what maybe other states have looked at this and says, hey, if it's a good idea for Oregon, it's a good idea for fill in the state name. So it'd be interesting if any other state does it or has some other modifications of it, and then what the history was behind the original concept.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. Let me ask another question too while we're talking about this. Is the federal limitation is based on AGI, is it, or is it on something else?
Yes, it's AGI.
So if we go with household income as a measure, we're taking a calculation of AGI, and then we're additionally calculating another basis for income before we ask people to figure out whether or not they get the deduction or not.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it adds a lot of complication.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's
the people are sick.
I think one of the and all right, and I think one of the issues that you raised earlier, Representative Butler, was that AGI, using AGI, would encourage people to change their income into a tax exempt mode, but you compare, given that we're talking about a 9% item on an amount that maximizes out at 7.5% of their AGI, whatever that is, they're unlikely to take the interest hit or their income hit by doing that as compared to taxable items just in order to make that avoidance, wouldn't you think? Because they'd be giving up a lot of money in other ways by doing that. I would think that once you've done the federal calculation, and then you've added the state calculation in, it doesn't pay to switch over to all non-taxable income items.
Mr. Chair, yes, there's in financial management and consultation, there would be a level at which people would not be moving to tax-free municipals because the taxable would actually yield them more after-tax dollars. So you're absolutely right. But in my experience, sometimes people don't think rationally when it comes to the payment of taxes. They come back and say, wait a minute, if this will save me taxes, even though I make more money by choosing this option over the other option, I'll do what I need to save more taxes. And that's probably more prevalent in the states south of us because they have a higher upper bracket to when you graduate up to that top end.
So this will provide more buyers for Oregon bonds,
Oregon municipals,
and reduce our interest rates.
Sounds like wartime. Buy more bonds. Huh?
Thank you. There were some other hands down here. Maybe not. I think we're not ready on this bill yet, but I think that it's a useful conversation, and you're going to do a little more research. All right. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2965. And we're ready to look at the bills that we carried over from yesterday.
More.
Oh, you were in the room.
I wasn't up here, but I was in the office.
Okay.
91. So it's a 1991 law, huh?
Correct. 91 is a medical subtraction from 1991.
Yeah, it was approved by the House Revenue Committee. 91.
All right. So
Paul, what, if I can ask, and I realize it's not open yet, what was the theory behind the 58 and then graduating it?
So we reopen on House Bill 2965. Go ahead.
Thank you. The question is, what was the theory behind the graduation of it? Was there someone in the assembly at that time that was 58 that was ill, that was deducting a lot of medical expenses, that wanted the full benefit at the Oregon 9% rate?
I don't know about that, last year, Butler, but the issue at that time was very much tied to pension taxation. As you recall, we had the federal court case. There was a number of efforts. In 89, the legislature approved a bill that taxed both federal pension income and PERS income. And that was referred by the federal retirees because the court case had ruled they had to be treated uniformly. Federal retirees referred that bill to the ballot, and it was defeated. So the state was back in a situation where it was treating PERS and federal retirement income differently and had to comply with federal law. So there was a series of issues in which trying to look at pension income, trying to look at basically how the state taxes the income of seniors and retirees, and that became part of the discussion. There was also a credit that was introduced at that time on general pension income that's still on the book, even though it's at a fairly low level of income. So it was part of that discussion and then approved as a way of because the assumption at the time was that you're going to begin to tax a lot of retirement income that had not been taxable before. So it was seen in conjunction with that. And of course, as later events happened, we ended up with the reverse of the situation we started out with, whereas federal pension retirement income prior to 91, accrued prior to 91, is non-taxable, and the PERS income is taxable. So we ended up with that solution after several court cases. But it was part of that 91 discussion about how we treat pension income.
Thank you. And I think we'll look at that again another time. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to confirm that I understood this correctly. Because of the federal 7.5%, if we were to move forward and sunset this, would a senior who was hit with some sort of catastrophic illness or medical event, they would still be protected, wouldn't they? Because above 7.5%, they would still get that deduction at the federal level. So what we would be doing by doing this is removing that protection from non-catastrophic events that are less than 7.5% of a person's annual income.
Representative Gelser, yes. I mean, if you just take the simple situation of 100,000, what we're saying is that over 7.5% of that is deductible on your federal return and on your state return. The amount up to 7.5% or up to 7,500 in our simple case is subtractable from your Oregon income only because of this law.
Thank you.
And what 2965 would do was allow that in place until you reach that income or means test level, and then it would start to phase out.
Thank you.
Right. And I think there's a piece of that. On the other, she's talking about the non-catastrophic cases. We're talking about relatively low amounts are deductible under Oregon law as they exist now. And this, what this bill would do is that for high-income people, that would no longer be deductible or only partly deductible. Then on the other hand, if you have very high medical expenses, let's say, you know, substantially more than your income, the entire amount would remain deductible, wouldn't it? Under federal law and under state law.
This should be the amount above 7.5%. So you have to; it has to be expenditures in excess of 7.5%.
Right. So if we had, in our case, a person with a $100,000 income, they had $150,000 of medical expenses, they would end up with a zero taxable income on for both federal and state returns, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Even with this bill.
Even with this bill, yes. If it I see Deborah's got pondering that. Maybe we should ask
Deborah. Maybe we should ask her to come up.
My interpretation, Mr. Chair, would be yes, because this bill applies to, you would still be eligible for the federal deduction as it's calculated. So it wouldn't change that deduction.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. if I might make the math even simpler for my purposes, $100,000 of adjusted gross income and $100,000 of medical expenses. On the federal return, they would be able to deduct the amount over $7,500, so they would still have $7,500 of taxable income. For Oregon, under current law, they would get that $7,500 as a deduction, so theirs would be zero. If this bill were passed and you look at federal AGI as the test, then there still is $100,000 of federal AGI, and the phase-out would allow them only a portion of the $7,500, but not all of it, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Now, suppose that that same person had $150,000 of medical expenses. The result's the same under either test, isn't it?
Well, again, you're looking at what is in excess of 7.5%
right.
of AGI.
Right.
And
so now we have a net of $142,500, whatever it is. And that would more than zero out your total income, wouldn't it, under either test?
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, that was the question I posed.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Is there anything else on this bill?
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I just wanted to say on the record how much I hope that we bring this bill back to work it. As we look at the co-chair's budget and the choices that we're making, this seems like it makes sense as a place to redirect some of this revenue. I mentioned in the last hearing the issue of how we've got lots of kids living outside the home. This would pay three times over for keeping hundreds of kids at home rather than just in this first biennium, and there would be much surplus after that. And as we make tough choices about where our dollars go, our tax expenditures are expenditures. This is an expenditure. I think that we have more appropriate places to spend our money. So I hope very much we bring it back.
Thank you, Representative. You may want to talk to some of your colleagues. We appreciate that. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one additional. I think Deborah was referring to a separate deductible portion, and that's the clawback. And I want to make sure that and I don't know that she was referring to it or not. Okay, she's not referring to the clawback. She's staying with it because certain amounts of your itemized deduction, you start to lose them after you have a certain amount of higher income, and at the $150,000 for a single individual, the itemized, you're going to be losing your itemized deduction anyway. And so there's a potential that you will lose some of your itemized deduction. However, the single individual who has $150,000 worth of medical expenses with $100,000 AGI, this bill wouldn't make any difference. But I would also like to say that there's, because we have separated now in part from federal, moved away from the reconnect, this also gives a kind of a skewed result on certain tax returns where you won't be itemizing for federal tax purposes. You don't have enough to itemize. But when you add back the 7.5% of deductible of the adjusted gross income, now all of a sudden you have a Schedule A that gets inserted for your state income tax return where you weren't itemizing previously. So it is truly an issue that has to be grappled with by tax preparers and individuals. But again, it certainly addresses some cases where folks are spending, particularly senior citizens, 62 and older, are spending a huge amount of their money on medical issues and receiving them the fact that they do not have to pay a 9% on that 7.5% deduction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Vice Chair Butler raises an important point about the administration or how individuals use the subtraction. They have to file an itemized Oregon that return, so they would have to use that in comparison with their Oregon standard deduction.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we had Deborah and Paul and Chris here available, if maybe we could find out the numbers of returns, because that's an easy number to pick up, I would think, where there's an itemized deduction on the Oregon and none on the federal. And that would give us then some additional feeling as to the array that this might fall in, because they can give us some income levels, and these are all going to be people 62 years of age and older.
That would be beneficial, I think. So we've got a couple of tasks for you to work on. So we'll now we'll reclose, if we're ready, on House Bill 2965, and we'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3048. And are you ready on that one, Paul?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
3048 and 3049 are both related to the calculation of the surplus kicker. What 3048 does is adjust the surplus kicker for the corporate credit calculation. As you recall, the corporate credit is calculated the same way it was since 79, when it first was put in statute by the legislature. And the way the calculation is done now, in August, now ignoring House Bill 2707, but under existing law, that the amount of corporate income tax revenue will be that actually comes in the door in the two-year period will be compared with the forecast, and that's more than 2%. What the state economist does is look at that amount above the forecast and then divides it by the estimated corporate liability in the current year. So that would be 2007. Now, of course, we're talking about him doing this in normal circumstances in August. And, of course, given data lags, we really don't know where the calculation is at that time. And the state economist, therefore, has to look at an estimate of what total liability is for 2007 based on his latest forecast and then figure a percentage credit. So if that percentage credit, if his liability estimate, for example, is too low compared to what it turns out to be, he'll figure out a percentage that will return more money than was actually above the forecast. And the reverse can occur as well. If he's too high in his forecast, then you'll end up returning less money than the amount above the forecast. And if you look at the back side of my sheet here, there's a of my staff measure summary. I think I just copied it to the back side. There is a little history of the corporate credit. And this comes out of the Revenue Department's research report. And as I said, you can come out higher or lower than the forecast, and I know because I've done it both ways. For example, in 93-95, the kicker was $167 million. It was above $167 million above the 93 forecast. The credit percentage, 50.1%, if you look on that fourth column there for 93-95, that was based on my estimate at the time of what corporate liability was. Well, I know it comes as a shock, but I was wrong, and it turned out that that estimate was too low, and that 50.1% actually returned $224 million instead of
$167.
Now, of course, you can see what happened. We were in the middle of this kind of upswing in corporate profits, similar to what we've seen in the last three or four years. And we were $203 million over the next biennium, but that had started to peak and started to drop by 97. So my estimate for 97 liability turned out to be actually too high that I based that 42.2% on. And the surplus credit that was actually returned when the department went back and looked at the returns was $169 million. So the state, you know, roughly broke even on those two biennia. But it just shows you the potential margin of error there because you're dealing with a number that is a forecast at the time. So what 3048 does is to do the same thing that's done on the personal return, and that is base the percentage on the prior year liability. Even that would have more margin of error on the corporate side because it takes so long for the data to come in. But still, that should be known with more accuracy than the current year because it would be history and we would have some returns and have a better idea of what that actually looked like. So that's what 3048 does, is it changes that estimate to the prior year. And you can see, and if you move forward in the future, 0305, for example, in this current biennium, we had estimated that it was $101 million would be the kicker at 35.9% credit. We returned $138 million, and that number is actually going to turn out to be higher than $138 million, given the patterns we've seen. And who knows? Well, the current kicker, you've made an adjustment on that one, but that's going to be a fairly large margin of error given the history of the corporate income tax and the difficulty of predicting it. So this bill should, in theory, bring the percentage and the amount above forecast closer in line with the amount that's actually credited. Now, there may be some administrative issues, and I've asked Deborah to comment on those from the standpoint of the department.
Great. Are there questions for Paul? Yeah, Representative Berger.
Paul, it's my understanding, then, that the actual credited amount of a kicker that kicks is not changed by this bill. It's how you estimate it that is changed by this bill.
That's correct, Representative Berger. The credit percentage is calculated by taking the amount above the forecast and dividing it by estimated liability.
Okay.
What this would do is, instead of dividing it by estimated liability for the current year, that's a projection, it would be estimated liability from the prior year.
Okay.
So the percentage would be
result
of that calculation.
Change. And it should change.
It would from year to year, but it should bring the actual amount of the credit more in line with the actual amount above the forecast.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
This is not constitutional. I mean, the kicker is constitutional, but the way that it's calculated is not. Is that my understanding?
That's correct, Christine Berger. The kicker statute or the Constitution gives the legislature authority for how to distribute that surplus.
Got it.
Right. That's right. And so the question really is, are we going to base it on a number that we have a more accurate estimate of than on a number that we have a less accurate estimate of? And it occurred to me when I decided to schedule the bill for hearing that a good year to make that kind of decision is a year in which it doesn't matter, like this one. Let's hear from Deborah Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. As Mr. Warner mentioned, we now have on the corporate tax return a process for returning kickers when they exist. We had one in 2005, and the process is that the taxpayer calculates taxable income, computes tax, deducts credits, gets to a net liability, and then there is a percentage on the return that they multiply the liability, subtract that, and get to their net either refund or amount that they owe. The bill, by moving the base date to the prior year, creates a disconnect between the return that they're filing and the base. We think we can probably administer that. Corporations make mistakes now in calculating the kicker. Some of them just don't claim it because they don't think it's correct, or we send the check out, they send the check back because they think we made a mistake. So we still do the calculations, and we would continue to do that. But it's likely that the rate of error would increase because you're using a prior year, a number that they don't have in front of them, in making that calculation. One thing the committee might want to consider, and I would say the same thing with the individual kicker, if when you look at that bill, is perhaps providing the department with a bit more flexibility in how it returns the money. Right now it says we shall return it as a credit on the return. One thing that I've thought of, and I haven't talked to programs, so they may say that I'm all wet on doing this, is but what you're really talking about is an overpayment of the liability, a percentage of the liability on the prior year's return. In other words, if we were talking about a 2007 corporate tax kicker, what you're allowing them is a credit or an overpayment, a carryover of overpaid tax from the 2006 return. So if you simply treated that as an overpayment of estimated tax that they're allowed to apply to the next year, that might be one way to do it. If we were to treat it as an additional estimated tax payment, that might be another way to do it. Some way to minimize the administrative issues and the taxpayers having to calculate this based on a prior year's tax. So that might be something to consider if you decide to move the bill forward. But having said that, I don't think we would have a lot of administrative issues with it. I do think we could make it work. It is different than the individual because it would still continue to be claimed on the return, whereas with the individuals, we send checks. So having said that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am intrigued with the mechanics of it, Deborah. the sending of some sort of a credit voucher for the ensuing year could be a method whereby, I mean, it's like a check, but it's a credit voucher, and you could specifically say, please include this online such and such. It would have to be in order to meet the definition of the kicker law. It would have to be a refundable credit too. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that is one of the issues that came up in talking with the program about this and writing the computer programming for a refundable credit for corporations. We don't have any of those at this point. And they said that would take some time and some effort. So if there's another way to get to it without actually creating a refundable credit on the 07 return, perhaps there's a way to do it by looking at the 06 return and allowing that as an overpayment. And I just throw that out there. I haven't really discussed it in any detail with the programs, but if we were able to come up with something that accomplished the same effect, that might be something for you to consider. A credit voucher is possible, although I think the percentage that's certified to us doesn't occur again until August or September. Some corporations will already have filed their 2006 return at that point. Another thing that I talked with Mr. Warner about is simply allowing the department to calculate it, not expecting the taxpayer to put it on the return themselves, but just inform them that we will calculate the kicker for you. We will either increase the amount of the refund that you're due or send you a refund check, essentially.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, and I apologize for a dialogue in this regard, but if you send it in the form of a credit voucher and they had filed their tax return, the credit voucher could say can be used on your 2007 return or on your 2008 return. You choose. And so if they've already filed their tax return at that particular point, they're holding a credit voucher, which will be good for taxes, which would be paid in a subsequent year, and would create an effect, I would think, again, it almost has to be a refundable voucher, almost treated like an estimated tax payment, and we have no refundable credits presently other than payments in the form of payments with the return or payments in estimated tax forms for corporations that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that's correct for corporations.
Right.
Other questions? So I think what you're asking for is a chance to take this home and tinker with it for a while and with the potential of coming back with amendments.
Mr. Chairman, we would appreciate that opportunity if the committee's willing to do that.
Well, we don't have it for work session today, so I think if you have a different idea, you ought to think about bringing it back to us.
Always the issue of the new corporation in Oregon presently that in effect distorts what can happen is when the corporation was not physically in existence in the year that the overpayment, the credit, actually occurred. This would certainly overcome that, the issuance of a credit based upon that prior year's return, because there would have been no prior year return.
Or a corporation with no nexus in Oregon.
That's right. No nexus. The next question is, what happens if there are a corporation that has a substantial Oregon investment, substantial Oregon, I'm thinking now of the Freightliners and the other companies, that just say, you know, we've paid our taxes in the state of Oregon, we've paid our dues, and we just can't continue to stay here. They pack up and they move their operations outside of the state, they would still be entitled to that credit voucher, but on a return which may or may not have any income or any income tax liability. And so I'm still looking at that and saying it really needs to be a refundable credit in order to fulfill the strict meaning of the kicker law, I would think. So it would have to be almost treated like an estimated tax voucher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that is the effect of disconnecting the years currently you cannot have a kicker unless you have a tax liability on that return.
Exactly.
And under this proposal, you may have no tax liability on the 2007 return,
but
your kicker exists because you had a liability for 2006. So you're exactly right.
Right.
The effect is that you're allowed a refund even though you have no liability for the year for which the kicker is claimed.
And, Mr. Chair, at that point, it just becomes the mechanics of how you issue that. And I would think that a credit voucher issued and put a time limit on it. Say it's got to be used in the ensuing year or the year thereafter, and after that, it's void. I mean, we're going to treat it, thank you very much, as part of the contribution to the Common School Fund because it becomes an effect.
It is cheats eventually. Thank you. The point, I think, of bringing this bill is to escape from the inaccuracies that creep in because of the estimating process. And I think as long as we keep that in mind, then your suggestions would be welcome.
Thank you.
And we appreciate it. Is there anything else for this witness? We have one other who would like to be heard. And I think we'll do that. And then we have one other item on our agenda, which we're going to have to carry forward again. We'll carry forward House Bill 3049 until tomorrow, and we'll hear from Don on this bill. And you see the time.
Yes,
hopefully
Chairman,
you can keep
you.
It brief.
Don Chong, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. While you're in the amendment mood, I come to you with an amendment not on the issue that you've been discussing, but on the issue of the personal kicker. And the issue that I bring before you is, and Representative Butler surely will recognize this issue, I assume that you have done many returns for agriculture producers, but it's not exclusive to agriculture, I'm sure. It may be more exclusive to small business. And that is the fact that the personal kicker is computed based on the last year of the biennium. And when you have wide disparaging income from year to year, that's like playing the lottery. You could have a big year on the last year and have paid no tax the previous year because you had a bad year, and you'd get a big refund. Conversely, maybe you had a good year 2 years ago, or at the end of the year of the biennium in which the kicker took effect, you had very little or no income tax liability, and so you'd get no kicker money back. And so this is not a revenue issue. It's an issue of fairness. It's an issue of taking the average of the 2 years and providing that the kicker is based on the average of the 2 years in the biennium rather than simply the last year of the biennium. Well, that's the purpose. Now, having said that, 3049, as it was introduced, I believe, also provided that you would take it as a refundable tax credit rather than a check in the mail. And if you also made that change, that would make this calculation on the income tax the year of the kicker very easily done. So that's my message, and I have a sheet that you have there, which the second sheet just talks about what the purpose is, and I don't know if I've correctly identified how you'd amend it or not, but that's the principle, and would ask for your support of that change in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Don?
Mr. Chair, that testimony is really more applicable to 3049, is it not?
Well, it is, except that the relating clause for 3048 is relating to surplus refunds. So
right.
It's definitely related to either bill. I mean, in the sense that the bill could be amended that way to do that. But both bills have the same relating clause, right. In effect. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. You have given me at least some additional thoughts on the issue. The point I think you're making, if I understand it correctly, is that using the current system with a check that's sent out late in the year for the personal kicker refund doesn't allow for this kind of averaging over 2 years. But if it were considered to be a credit in this case the 07 tax return, it could be done as a on the basis of an averaging. of 06 and 07 as a part of that process. So in that sense, it could relate to either bill, I suppose. Yeah. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And with that, we're only 3 minutes late, and we will close the public hearing and adjourn.